Harry Cliff is a particle physicist working on the Large Hadron Collider, the huge particle detector which is 17 miles long and buried deep underground at CERN near Geneva. He's part of an international team of around 1,400 physicists, engineers and computer scientists studying the basic building blocks of our universe in search of answers to some of the biggest questions in modern physics. He's also passionate about explaining these mysteries to us. He's created two major exhibitions at the Science Museum, one about the Hadron Collider, another about the Sun, and his first book was called How to Make an Apple Pie from Scratch, which I believe, Harry, is a quote from the American astronomer Carl Sagan.
Yeah, that's right. It's from his famous TV series documentary Cosmos. It's a very strange opening to one of the episodes, which is actually called The Lies of the Stars, where you see an apple pie being baked with a soundtrack that sounds like it's out of Blade Runner, sort of, you know, 1980s synth. This apple pie is brought out to him and he's actually sitting in Trinity College, Cambridge, and he looks at the camera with a little twinkle in his eye and says, if you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. And apologies for my accent. But the point he's making is that, you know, if you want to understand even a really mundane object like an apple pie, you have to understand the origins of everything going right back to the Big Bang. And that's sort of where the title came from.
You've brought us a lovely music list, Mahler, Debussy, Strauss, Stravinsky. But we're starting with a piece that's a wonderful build-up to things, isn't it?
Yeah, so this piece is Zadok the Priest by Handel. So I don't have much of a musical career. I did have piano lessons when I was a child, but neither of my parents are musicians. And as a result, I had no sort of role model to aim for. But I did have a reasonable singing voice. I never got very far with the piano, but I was in the school choir, and the sort of height of my musical career, such as it was, the choir went to St. John Smith Square and did a performance in London, and we performed this piece. And so this sort of brings back memories of being about 12 years old before my voice broke and I lost the ability to sing for a while.
Handel holds the suspense before the choir come in, doesn't he? Which always makes it a marvellous moment.
Yeah, that build-up is incredible. Actually, watching the coronation last year with some friends, one of my friends have a young toddler. And when the music started playing, she kind of got really livened up, absolutely obsessed with it, and kept demanding that it be played over and over again. But when the choral music came in, she said, oh, no, I want you to go back to the beginning. She just loved that kind of musical intro.
Well, for her and for you, here it is.
Thank you.
Well, I think if there was a Nobel Prize, not for physics, but for delayed gratification, Handel would get it, don't you?
Yeah. It must have been extraordinary to be at the coronation of George II when that was first performed.
Did you find singing it as exciting as listening?
Yeah, very much so. I still remember actually quite vividly the feeling of being on the stage and the audience sitting out in front of us and the moment you kind of come in.
Say Doc the Priest, the coronation anthem number one, performed by the choir of King's College, Cambridge, the Academy of Ancient Music, conducted by Stephen Clebury. Tell me a little bit about your early life. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Bromley in southeast London. My parents both worked for British Telecom. So I had a sort of a fairly ordinary, I guess, middle-class upbringing, went to a local Church of England school. And then that part of South London is one of the sort of few places in the country where there's still a number of grammar schools. So I ended up going to the local grammar school, which was, you know, a very good place, actually, in terms of getting a good education, a very supportive environment and with really good teaching. So I was very fortunate in a lot of ways.
Was science an early interest?
Yeah, so both my parents studied science at university. So my mum did chemistry and my dad, well, he started off thinking he was going to be a physicist, but then ended up switching to history and philosophy of science. I think she found a bit more enjoyable. But they both encouraged an interest in science from an early age. So yeah, I was always fascinated by, I think the thing particularly that drew me in about physics is the fact that it allows you to explain a very complicated world in terms of real simplicity, the idea that you can boil down everything that we see in the world around us to a very small number, really, of basic ingredients. And, you know, physics sounds complicated, but actually the laws that govern the way these things interact are really simple. If you compare it to something like economics or human interaction, the way particles interact is really, really simple.
And do you remember when you first got fascinated by magnets? Because I know there's something that you love working with.
Yeah, I mean, I think magnets are about as close as you can get to real magic in everyday life. I mean, most people, if you've, you know, you've at school or at some point held a magnet and pushed the two North Poles towards each other and you feel this thing pushing back on you, you can't see anything. If you look in the gap between the magnets, there's nothing there. You can put your hand there, you know, but it's undeniable there's a physical thing there. And what I find amazing about this is when you do this, what you're really experiencing is actually the fundamental building blocks of everything in the universe. So here, in this case, it's a magnetic field. I mean, I certainly remember at school doing the classic experiment that probably a lot of people did, which is something that Michael Faraday, a physicist of the 19th century, did, where you put a magnet under a piece of paper and you scatter iron filings on top of it and you see that the iron filings arrange themselves in these beautiful loops, these magnetic field lines. So you're making this invisible magnetic field visible. I think I remember doing that when I was about 10 or 11 at school and finding it magic. But despite being a particle physicist, actually, we don't think of particles as being the most fundamental objects in the universe. We actually think of particles as manifestations of things called quantum fields, which are, you can think of them as sort of invisible fluids or oceans. They fill the whole universe. And every electron or quark in the atoms in our bodies is a little vibration in these otherwise invisible fields. So when you hold a magnet, what you're really feeling there is the physical reality of these things that are otherwise, you know, intangible and unknowable, but are actually fundamental to our existence.
You have a Scottish heritage, don't you?
Yes, my mum's Scottish. She was born in Glasgow and grew up in Kirkcaldy in Fife. Actually, she went to the same Kirkcaldy High School in the same year as Gordon Brown, funnily enough. So the next piece, actually, that I've picked reminds me of her very much. We had a lot of holidays when we were children going up to see our relatives in Kirkcaldy or going further north into the Highlands. And one place we used to go a lot, and I still go, is a small village called Lochinver in the far northwest Highlands. And the mid-90s, we were there for a week, and there was a folk band advertised playing in the village hall called the McCalmans, and they were absolutely brilliant, very funny, but also wrote some really beautiful music as well. And so from then on, a couple of their CDs were constant companions driving from Scotland to England. And this particular next piece is called Far Down the Line, which I think my mum always found quite affecting, because it's essentially about a Scottish man who is leaving Edinburgh, moving down to London because he's got to sort of pursue his career down there, feels that there aren't enough opportunities in Scotland. And I think my mum actually, she studied at Edinburgh University and she got a job at the post office. And originally the job was in Edinburgh, but then she was suddenly told at the last minute she was going to have to move to London because that was the only place where a job was available. So I think she left Scotland feeling quite ambivalent about this move south. And so this song, I think she always found quite affecting.
People often say the great export of Scotland is people. And that's happened for various reasons over many hundreds and hundreds of years. And I always think nowadays it's a shame. People get set off from Edinburgh and Glasgow and Dundee and they say they've got to go to London. Must go to London, hit the big back smoke, and that's fine, but I always think we're diminished a wee bit. So this is a song about a guy from Edinburgh, and he's setting off, and he's saying, I'll go down to London, make my money, I'll be back in a few years, don't worry about me, I'll be back. And he takes a last pint at Leslie's Bar on the south side, lovely old bar, and he has a look round and goes, oh, I'll be back. And you kind of know that he won't be. The song's called Far Down the Line.
You'll drink a last pint up in Leslie's on the way. They say the beer will taste more bitter from today. You take a long look at the skyline from the bridge and watch the morning sun explore the old town's ridge. You've heard it all, you've said it all, it's time to go. You'll find a better life in England, sure you know. You had to smile when old friends sadly shook their heads. Come on, it's no the moon I'm going to, you said. Now you're waiting on the London train, and it won't be long before you leave it all behind. There's no pipe band playing, well, you know, come back again. Far down the line, far down the line. It's no for long, you'll make your money and return. But in the morning light, you'll watch the Tweed Bridge burn. You dream the South will bring you all the things you lack. You can scarcely hear the land that calls you back. And when the team in blue run out, you'll raise a cheer. You can sing the flower of Scotland once a year. Though you promised that you'd always keep in touch, well, you were never one for letters very much. Now you're waiting on the London train, and it won't be long before you leave it all behind. There's no pipe band playing, well, you know, come back again. Far down the line, far down the line. And will you hang around the pubs of Camden Town? Will you let them call you Jock the Tartan Clown? When you're drunk at Hogmanay, will you believe that you still mourn the land you were so keen to leave? And there are thousands, many thousands of your kind, Beth and Stornoway and Kirkwall left behind. When they ask you why you took the long road south, you'll say you had no choice, there's no one left there now. Now you're waiting on the London train, and it won't be long before you leave it all behind. There's no pipe band playing, well, you know, come back again. Far down the line, far down the line. You'll drink a last pint up in Leslie's on the way. They say the beer will taste more bitter from today. You take a long look at the skyline from the bridge and watch the morning sun explore the old town's ridge. You've heard it all, you've said it all, it's time to go. You'll find a better life in England, sure you know. You had to smile when old friends sadly shook their heads. All it's no, the moon I'm going to, you said. Now you're waiting on the London train, and it won't be long before you leave it all behind. There's no pipe band playing, well, you know, come back again. Far down the line, far down the line, far down.
Well, it says it all, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, that story of people leaving Scotland to come to London was certainly true, I think, in the sort of 70s and 80s, but it's gone the other way now, actually. So now more people are moving to Scotland from the rest of the UK.
Especially post-COVID.
Yeah.
Far down the line from the McCalmonds, from their album Festival Lights. You studied physics at Cambridge University, Harry Cliff.
Yes, that's right. And I found learning physics at university incredibly satisfying. I think it's the period in my life where I've probably thought the deepest, you know, where you would sit with a problem, struggling with it for hours, trying to figure out how you kind of codify some physical problem in mathematics. And one experience where I remember I'd spent hours one afternoon trying to solve this problem, been unable to do it, and had gone to bed with it sort of going around in my head. And then about 3 a.m, I'd woken up and suddenly knew the answer and went over to my desk, switched the light on, wrote it down and went back to sleep. And then sort of woke up in the morning and thought, did that really happen? And then you go to the desk and there's the solution written out for you. I found that really, really exciting.
Having sung in a choir, did you see analogies with music and mathematics?
There's a lot of resonance, I think, between music and physics. And in fact, you know, the way that we describe the universe in particle physics in terms of vibrations of fields, I think, you know, really there's a great similarity, I think, there to music. So many of the people applying to do physics also were very gifted musicians. Unfortunately, I'm not one of them.
That's interesting. When did you first hear about the Large Hadron Collider?
Well, I mean, when I was doing my undergraduate degree, it was being built. And I think actually you probably first heard about it towards the end of school. But this is a project that had been in the works since really the late 70s. That's when the first conversations about building this thing happened. But when I finished my undergraduate degree, this was 2008, and the machine was just about to switch on for the first time. And I actually, having really enjoyed physics at university, the first time I went to CERN was in 2007 as a summer student. People from all over Europe come and spend the summer and do little projects. And I was really excited about this. But when I got there, I found the whole experience really quite alienating, basically because the supervisor who was supposed to be looking after me wasn't there. And so I had no idea what I was doing. And a lot of particle physics, if you're doing experiment, involves computer coding. And in those days, at least, you got very limited computer coding training as part of your undergraduate course. So I was completely unequipped to do the work and I didn't know what I was doing. So I came away from that experience thinking, God, this isn't how I want to spend, you know, the next 4 years of my life. And I happened to get speaking to a guy called Martin White, who I later discovered is the most enthusiastic man in physics. And he was saying, you know, look, we've been building this machine for 10 years. We're going to discover all these things. It's an incredibly exciting moment. You've got to do it. And so that was the moment where I sort of changed my mind.
He reignited the fuse.
Absolutely. So it's all his fault, essentially.
For people who are not certain about what the Large Hadron Collider does, just tell us about it.
As an instrument, it's the sort of simplest thing you could think of doing. You want to know what the world is made of, so you take little bits of the world in the form of subatomic particles, you accelerate them around this 27-kilometer ring until they're going incredibly quickly, 99.9999991% of the speed of light, and then you crash them into each other and you see what happens. So where they collide, you have these big detectors, and their job is to record what happens in the collision. And what the machine really does is, the reason you go to these incredibly high speeds is that when the particles collide, they have a huge amount of energy, and that energy can be converted into new forms of matter. So you're essentially creating matter out of energy. We talked about this idea that the universe is made of quantum fields. Essentially what happens is that these quantum fields are set vibrating. It's like kind of, you know, hitting a drum incredibly hard. And you essentially are looking for new frequencies, new notes that you've not seen before, so new particles. So these detectors are then looking at these collisions to see, when we smash these things into each other, did we excite something out of the vacuum, some new particle that we've not seen before?
It's a fascinating world. I can see why you're gripped by it.
Yeah, I mean, CERN is an extraordinary place in many ways. I think it's funny, as I think a visitor, the first time you go there, there is this real disparity between what you encounter above ground, which is essentially a kind of 1960s, 70s shabby university campus with corrugated iron roofed buildings and offices that don't have central heating. I'd imagined CERN as this kind of gleaming futuristic place. And I was confronted with this sort of slightly dreary environment. I thought, well, is this really it? And then you go underground, and you go 100 meters underground down a lift, and you see the machines and you see the detectors, which are cathedral size, these incredible looking objects. They look like sort of something out of science fiction movie, like Stargate. And you can see, well, all the money is going underground and very little is spent on the on the accommodation for the physicists.
In 2013, you made an exhibition all about the Large Hadron Collider with the Science Museum in London.
Yes, that's right. So I was very, very lucky. I got this extraordinary role where I was half-time doing particle physics research and the other half as a curator at the Science Museum. And the problem with the LHC is it's so vast, there's no way you can fit it in a museum. So you have to somehow evoke that environment. And what we decided to do was try to take visitors on an actual journey to CERN using techniques from theatre. So it ended up being a sort of mixture of a promenade theatre show and a science exhibition. So the entire exhibition was set up as if you were walking into various laboratory spaces, the tunnels of CERN. And one of the bits actually interesting that was most popular with visitors was that we recreated one of these 1970s office corridors. Because by looking at all the sort of the texture on the surfaces of these walls, you've got a real sense of the community of CERN, the sort of international nature of the environment, but also the sort of physics in jokes that people were telling, pin boards and little jokes stuck to people's office doors. And so at the end of the exhibition, you literally walk into this kind of recreated corridor, and then you can go into the office where a young student who's working on the data analysis for the Higgs boson discovery is sort of sleeping under her desk.
At the launch party of the exhibition, you had another one of those great pieces that has a sort of extraordinary build-up, didn't you?
Yes, the director of the Science Museum arranged for the Philharmonia to come and play Also Sprach Zarathustra by Strauss, which I suppose for a scientist is maybe a bit of a cliched choice, but it's also from one of my favourite movies, 2001, A Space Odyssey. The exhibition was very fortuitous in terms of its timing because it launched a month after Peter Higgs had been given the Nobel Prize, along with François Englert, for the prediction of the Higgs boson. And at this event, we had Peter Higgs and Stephen Hawking, along with Ian McEwan, the author, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and, you know, the Director General of CERN. So it was this kind of, as a 27-year-old, you know, relatively new into their career, I suddenly found myself having to give this tour of the exhibition to this incredibly senior group of people, which was slightly terrifying. But I remember just, you know, after that, we then went up into the reception and this piece of music was played, which was a really kind of dramatic opening to the event.
It builds to an explosive moment, doesn't
yes.
it, when the brass come in.
Much like the Large Hadron Collider, I suppose.
I love the organ echoing on.
Mm.
What that music rather says to me is that anything is possible. You know, the first fanfare goes into the minor, bum, bum, and then the next one towards the end into the major, as though the world is opening up, which, of course, is, I think, why it was so effective in 2001.
Yeah. You think how different that film would be if they hadn't made the decision to use Strauss.
Let's hear a little bit about the specific experiments you're working on at the Large Hadron Collider, particularly the wonderfully named beauty quarks. What are they?
So I work on an experiment called LHCb. You have this 27-kilometre ring, and there are four places on that ring, separated by many miles, where you have these big detectors 100 metres underground. And I work on one of them, so this is LHCb. The B in LHCb stands for beauty, which is the name of one of the quarks. Now, quarks are fundamental particles that make up ordinary matter. So we are made of actually three different particles. Everything in the universe, actually, that we can see is made of electrons and then something called an up quark and a down quark. And that's it. So there's three things, and that's anything you like, from stars to human beings. But in nature, there are actually additional particles that are unstable, so they don't exist in the universe normally, but you can make them in high-energy collisions, for example. And one of these is the beauty quark. And it's essentially a very heavy version of the down quark that is inside ordinary atoms. I mean, the name is interesting, actually. So physicists have a pretty checkered history when it comes to naming new particles that they've discovered. And when the last two quarks were discovered, they were known as the beauty and the truth quark, or at least that's what some people tried to call them. But in the end, there was a big debate, and that was viewed as being too poetic. So they became known as the top and the bottom quark. So actually, most physicists refer to this particle as the bottom quark. But because we study it, we rather be known as beauty physicists than bottom physicists. But the reason this thing is interesting is that these particles are very sensitive to the existence of, for example, new forces of nature that we've not seen before. So the basic kind of research that we do at LHCb is to make many, many billions of these beauty quarks at the Large Hadron Collider and then make very precise measurements of their properties. You make one of these things and it lives for about 1.5 trillionths of a second, which is may sound like a very short period of time, but for a particle, that's quite a long time. And it's actually long enough for it to fly maybe a centimeter or so in your detector, and then it will decay and it will turn into some other particles. And then you compare your measurement with the prediction from our best theory of particle physics. And if there is a difference between the experimental result and the prediction, that is an indirect clue that these beauty particles are being affected by something new that we haven't seen before. So that could be a new force or a new particle. So that's essentially the game we play. I mean, the analogy I often use, it's imagine you're looking for an animal in a big, dark jungle. And if the jungle's very large and the animal's quite sort of secretive, you might not have a very good chance of actually stumbling upon the animal itself. So what might be a more canny strategy is to look around the forest floor and look for footprints, or perhaps look for a broken branch here and there. And that's sort of what we're doing. So these beauty quarks are a way of sort of looking at the landscape and seeing if a large animal somewhere is plodding about in it and giving you a clue to then where to go and look for the new thing that might be causing the effect.
How much do we know about what really makes up our universe? I mean, for example, we know there's dark matter, don't we? We know there's known particles. What are we finding out about what we are?
In some sense, we know a huge amount, and we also know that we know almost nothing. I mean, thanks to astronomy, we now know that actually what we can see in the night sky, so stars and galaxies, only represents about 5% of the total content of the universe, and 95% of which is made of completely unknown substances that we call dark energy and dark matter, which are really just words to cover our ignorance. We're essentially in this extraordinary position of thinking we'd figured everything out and then realizing we have only really scratched the surface of what's out there. And this is one of the big reasons for thinking that there must be new fundamental ingredients in the universe to discover. So finding, for example, the particle or set of particles that is responsible for dark matter, this stuff that is all around us and is out there in the universe, and is there's much more of it than there is of the stuff we're made from. We're trying to figure out essentially what is this dark stuff actually made from, and we'd like to see some evidence of that at the Large Hadron Collider.
And is dark matter the same as black holes, or is dark matter in black holes?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. One idea is that dark matter, which makes up about 27% of the universe, five times more of it than ordinary matter, could be made of black holes. A black hole is essentially the endpoint of a very massive star. When it's run out of fuel, its core collapses. You get something called a supernova. And then what's left behind is an object that's so dense that the gravity of that object is so strong that nothing can escape it, not even light. So that's why it's called black. So literally nothing can get out of this thing. There's a supermassive black hole weighing millions of times the mass of our sun in the center of our galaxy. And there are black holes with masses of around the mass of our sun, you know, throughout the galaxy. But there aren't enough of them to explain dark matter. So we don't think that dark matter is made of black holes. There's something else that's invisible out there, some kind of new particle or set of particles that we've yet to discover.
One of the pieces that really excited me about music, in the same way that physics excited you, was Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, a piece that seemed to harness a new language in some way. But you first encountered it when you were quite young.
Yeah, that's right. Probably, I imagine, true for a lot of young people, their first encounter with classical music is through the Disney film Fantasia. So I remember, I mean, like all six-year-old boys, I think, more or less, at that time, I was obsessed with dinosaurs. So in Fantasia, The Rite of Spring is set against this illustration of the formation of the Earth, you know, volcanoes and so on, and then the evolution of the dinosaurs and leading up to their eventual extinction. I used to rewind and rewatch that bit of the video over and over again. So that piece of music became very much ingrained in my mind.
The sounds are just wonderful, aren't they? We were both smiling at each other and chuckling with those bassoons. We heard the opening of the Rite of Spring with the Cleveland Orchestra, conducted by Pierre Boulez. Harry Cliff, one of the great successes of the Large Hadron Collider was the discovery of the Higgs boson. Why was that quite so significant?
Well, the Higgs is really central to our understanding of the basic building blocks of the universe. The role it plays, really, is that it's responsible for giving mass to the fundamental particles that we're made out of. So actually, this new particle that was discovered at the LHC in 2012 is really evidence for the existence of an invisible field that fills the whole universe. So a little bit like a magnetic field. In a way, you can kind of think of this Higgs field as like an invisible fluid that fills every inch of the universe. And its role is essentially this: when particles like electrons, the things that we're made from, move through this field and interact with it, they acquire mass. And this is important because if particles didn't have mass, then the universe could not exist as it does. There would be no atoms in the universe. There would be no structure in the universe. It would be filled essentially with a haze of particles zipping around at the speed of light, and we would not exist. But that's not really the end of the story, because actually this Higgs field is at the center of many of the biggest mysteries in physics. And so actually the real mission of particle physics in the next half century is going to be to really understand exactly what is this Higgs boson thing and what role did it play in bringing the universe as we know it into existence.
And is that why we need, or scientists think we need, a still larger collider?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the LHC is pretty big, but we will still only have a fairly fuzzy picture of the Higgs boson. It's essentially like having a sort of slightly blurry photograph taken from a long distance. But to really zoom in on this thing, we need a new type of machine that will require a larger footprint. And essentially what this machine will do is collide electrons and their antiparticles, which are called positrons, and it will make millions of Higgs bosons in a very precise, pristine environment. Now, that might sound a bit sort of nerdy and, you know, fastidious, but actually the reason for doing this is you're actually probing physical processes that took place in the first trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. So there was this event that took place in the universe that allowed everything to exist. So very shortly after the Big Bang, there was a phase transition in the early universe. A phase transition you come across in school might be, you know, steam condensing to make water droplets. Something very similar happened in the early universe, where the Higgs field essentially turned on. This fluid kind of essentially appeared in the universe. Particles acquired mass, and then the things that we're made of acquired their current properties, and that allowed the universe as we know it to form. And we don't really understand how this process happened. And so by building this machine, this will allow us to get more information on the Higgs boson, but also on the physics of the very early universe, in order to understand, you know, essentially how we got here.
How much bigger is it going to be?
Well, it depends on which machine gets built. There are various proposals on the market. CERN is backing something called the Future Circular Collider. That would be 90 kilometres in circumference if it's built.
Well, having spent quite so much time underground, I can see why you want to turn your attention to the moon next.
Yeah, so this next piece, Debussy's Clair de Lune. I was coming back from a ski trip in Italy just at the start of 2020. So this was just before COVID hit. It was the last holiday I went on for many years. And we were in Turin Airport, and I sort of wandered off and left my group of friends. And I suddenly heard this piece of music being played on a piano. I sort of walked around the corner and discovered my good friend Tristram sitting at this grand piano that had been set up in the middle of the departures lounge, playing from memory Clair de Lune. And so Tris is he's this very sort of tall, silent engineer. He's not a show-off at all, but he's extremely musically talented. And, you know, occasionally you'll get this little flash where you get this insight into this whole other world that, you know, he doesn't show very often. And there was a big crowd of people gathered around. And when he finished, you know, about 100 people were applauding. It was really a sort of lovely moment. And that's what this piece reminds me of that.
Thank you.
Clair de Lune.
Beautiful.
It's got a kind of great calmness to it, doesn't it?
It really does. It's almost sort of like rain, the, sort of the sound of the piano.
Well, we now think there is water on the moon, don't we?
Frozen at the poles, yes, that's right.
Debussy's Clair de Lune, the third movement of the suite Bergamasque, performed by Jean-Yves Thibaudet. In 2018, Harry Cliff, you created another exhibition at the Science Museum, this time called The Sun, Living with Our Star, looking at how the sun shapes our sense of time, how we've harnessed its power, but also some of its secrets. Because it's true to say, isn't it, that for a long time we knew very little about it.
It's extraordinary, actually. If you go back 100 years, we didn't know what the sun was made from, and we didn't know how it was powered. So we essentially knew more or less nothing. Kelvin, who was one of the leading physicists of the time, essentially said the Earth could be no more than a couple of million years old or so, because that was assuming it was a lump of coal. This is the Victorian era, so everything's made of coal. There is this big problem that the sun appears to be younger than the Earth, and the resolution of this ultimately is the discovery of nuclear energy and the realization that the sun is a nuclear furnace. But yes, I mean, that discovery really began to be understood in the 1920s, around the same time that we started to figure out for the first time what the sun was made from. And I suppose one of the biggest revolutions actually in astronomy, which is this slightly obscure subject in some ways known as spectroscopy, which is where if you take light, for example, from the sun or from stars, and you put it through a prism and break it up, you'll get a familiar rainbow spectrum. But if you look at that spectrum very closely with a microscope, you'll see along the rainbow band these dark and bright lines that appear, a bit like a kind of barcode. And what people gradually realized was that this barcode essentially was the chemical fingerprint of different atoms in the atmosphere of the sun. And each atom has its own unique set of colors. And that was actually done by one of the first female astrophysicists, Cecilia Payne, who was the first person really in America to realize the sun isn't made of the same stuff as the Earth, that it's this big ball of hydrogen and helium.
Now we are able to use powerful telescopes to study stars beyond our solar system. What are we learning about their role in the production of elements?
Well, a huge amount still, actually. So one of the really interesting things that was discovered relatively recently, back in 2017, an extraordinary new type of telescope, which is called a gravitational wave detector. So this is a telescope that doesn't look at the universe in light. It looks at the universe in ripples in the fabric of space and time itself. So if you think of space as sort of like an elasticated sheet, it's a bit like someone sort of, you know, hit it and it's wobbling and this wave travels the universe. This instrument called LIGO in America picked up a gravitational wave signature. And these are usually caused by two extremely massive objects crashing into each other at some very distant point in the universe. So the first one they saw were two black holes that were in this death spiral around each other. And as they collided, they created this almighty vibration in space-time that traveled through the universe for over a billion years, I think, until eventually it reached us as this very, very faint wobble, which they amazingly managed to pick up. But then in 2017, they detected another one of these waves, but this time it appeared to not come from black holes, but from the collision of two neutron stars, which are not black holes. They're what happens if you don't quite make it to be a black hole. They're incredibly dense, hard objects. They're essentially like giant atomic nuclei, the size of a city, so about the size of London. Two of these things had smashed into each other. And because they're physical hard objects, you don't just get a gravitational wave, you get an almighty burst of light. And when LIGO told optical telescopes around the world to look to the point in the sky where this thing came from, they saw this glow of light. And when they analysed the light, they found that this collision had produced vast quantities of gold and platinum, so precious elements. And by one estimate, I think this collision had made 30 solid gold Earths worth of gold. Previously, it was thought that gold and platinum and precious metals came from dying stars called supernovae. We now know, actually, the majority of them come from these neutron star collisions. So if you own a piece of gold jewellery or a piece of platinum jewellery, you are essentially wearing a bit of a cataclysmic explosion colliding between two dead stars billions of years in the past, which is, I think, you know, utterly extraordinary.
Amazing thought.
Yeah.
The great polyphonic English composer next, William Byrd.
Yes, Ave Verum Corpus, that I recently heard performed at St Bartholomew's the Great in Smithfield in London to mark the 400th anniversary of William Byrd's death. St. Bart's is the oldest church. I think it dates from the 12th century. Mm. And it was just an extraordinary evening. The choir Sansara just got filled this ancient building with this incredibly rich sound just from the power of their voices.
Well, they very kindly let us have a recording from a rehearsal made that day at St. Bartholomew the Great, because there isn't yet a commercial disc. So we can hear exactly what you were listening to.
Oh, how fantastic.
Beautiful. William Byrd's Ave Verum Corpus, performed by Sansara. And we're very grateful to Tom Herring for making available that recording from a rehearsal on the day you were there, Harry Cliff.
That was really very kind of him. That's extraordinary. It was wonderful hearing that again.
As we mentioned in the introduction, your first book, How to Make an Apple Pie from Scratch, was inspired by Carl Sagan. Now, you have admitted that there are some gaps in the apple pie recipe.
Mm.
Why is that?
Yeah, so we've come a very long way in understanding the origins of the universe and what it's made from. If you take an object and you trace its ingredients back through cosmic history, we can go more or less back to about a millionth of a second after the Big Bang. And that is incredible. You know, so we have a very, in some sense, complete history of the universe. But when you get back beyond about a millionth of a second, there things start to get uncertain. And there are various things we believe happened that we don't yet understand. So, for example, if you have to imagine the very early universe is this incredibly hot, energetic, much, much smaller than it is today. So the universe is essentially filled with this superheated gas. And in that first millionth of a second, lots of very important things happen. So it may be a very short period of time, but the processes that took place in that first millionth of a second gave rise to essentially the universe as we know it today. So understanding that first tiny fraction is crucial. To give you one example, so we believe in the very early universe, there was this constant process where matter was being created from energy at the same time as its mirror opposite was being created, something called antimatter. So antimatter is a sort of mirror image of matter where an antiatom is exactly the same. The only difference is the particles that make it up have the opposite electric charge. And in our current theory, whenever you make a particle, you also make an antiparticle. So in the early universe, you have particle and antiparticle being created. They're crashing into each other, annihilating. About a millionth of a second after the Big Bang, the universe expands enough and cools down that this process of creation and destruction stops. And what happens essentially is you have a universe with equal amounts of matter and antimatter that very rapidly meet up and they annihilate each other. So you have this event that Frank Close calls the Great Annihilation, essentially this point where everything in the universe should get wiped out. And what should have happened after that moment is you end up with a universe with nothing in it, just light, essentially. So the fact that we are here and there's physical stuff in the universe is a big mystery. We think that it should not have happened that way, that everything should have got wiped out in the first millionth of a second. So if you want to know where an apple pie comes from, when we get back to about a millionth of a second, we're kind of stuck. And that's the reason that we do experiments at the Large Hadron Collider, is why people make astronomical observations of the heavens, is to try to understand these kinds of mysteries.
Still on the subject of cooking, I think it slightly prompted your next piece.
Yeah, so this piece reminds me of a period during COVID in lockdown. I was quite lucky to be living with a friend at the time rather than being stuck on my own, as a lot of people were. My flatmate Simon was a very keen cook, so because we couldn't spend our money on anything else, we ended up making quite elaborate meals. And he's a very big Mahler fan, so I would quite often come into the kitchen on a Sunday as he was making some roast of some kind, air conducting to Mahler's Second Symphony, which is his absolute favourite piece of music.
Thank you.
Music from the Symphony No. 2 in C minor, The Resurrection by Mahler, performed by the soprano Kate Royal, the mezzo-soprano Magdalena Kozina, and the Berlin Radio Choir and Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Simon Rattle. Do you find that music inspiring? It has a kind of almost transcendental feel to it, doesn't it?
It does, particularly the very final part with the sort of the church bells that come in. I read somewhere that Mahler said when he heard it performed, it was so tremendous he didn't know how he'd written it, which I thought was quite nice. Sometimes in science, or I think probably in many areas, you have that experience of seeing something you've done and not really quite knowing how you did it. I mean, not that I've ever done anything on the scale of the Second Symphony, but even solving some minor problems, sometimes you're like, I don't really understand how I made that creative leap to do that.
And it's probably like composers who sometimes feel that the wrong note becomes the right note. Does that happen in science, that you accidentally hit something which is really quite important?
It happens a lot, actually. The quote that actually I start the new book, Space Oddities, with is one from Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer, which is, the most exciting phrase to hear in science is not eureka, but that's funny. And so a really good example of this, actually, probably the most profound discovery you could argue of the 20th century, is a discovery made by two American radio astronomers who were working with a radio antenna outside New York in the 1960s, and they were trying to do radio observations of the sky. And they discovered this annoying background noise in their instrument, this sort of hum effect, radio microwave hum. They couldn't figure out what this was. They thought maybe it was radio broadcast from New York. Eventually, they got inside the horn and found some pigeons that had taken up roost. They cleaned up their mess and thought maybe that didn't get rid of it. And eventually, they realized this annoying hum was actually the faded light from the Big Bang. And what they had discovered, this irritating bit of noise, was actually essentially the echo of creation itself. And that was the key bit of evidence that convinced everyone the universe really had a beginning. And it's kind of hard to think of a more profound discovery than that. And that came from some funny little niggle in their instrument. So, yeah, these kind of serendipitous discoveries happen all the time.
Amazing. Did the title of this book, Space Oddity, come from the David Bowie song?
It did. I mean, actually, my interest in him really was sparked by the V&A about a decade ago, did an exhibition called David Bowie Is, which was one of the most extraordinary shows I've ever seen. I already knew some of his music, but after that exhibition became very interested. So yeah, this next piece is his first big hit, Space Oddity. And there's a lovely story behind it. So Bowie, like me, grew up in Bromley in South London. And I read a biography of him by Dylan Jones. In the late 60s, he was lodging in a house in Beckenham with a woman who had, I think, two children. And she described her coming home from work and finding David Bowie sitting on the kitchen table. And he performed. He's like, oh, I've got this new song I want to play you. And so she and her children sat down and he performed pretty much for the first time Space Oddity, that went on to become this enormous hit and really launched his career.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2.
Check ignition and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. Now it's time.
wonderful song, David Bowie's Space Oddity. And staying with them, Harry Cliff, I was fascinated to read about a huge gamma ray burst that happened on October the 9th, 2022. What was the significance of that?
Yeah, these strange things are happening out there in the universe all the time. This incredibly bright flash of gamma rays swept through the solar system and actually dazzled orbiting spacecraft. It was so bright. And
it would have put Major Tom off his stride.
Major Tom would not have enjoyed it, I don't think. And when astronomers analysed what they'd seen, they realised this was the most brilliant explosion that had been witnessed in all of human history, essentially. And they you know, the biggest bang, potentially, since the Big Bang. So this is what we call a gamma ray burst, which... well, are believed by the sort of common theory that they are supernovae. So these are dying stars that are imploding in on themselves and then they explode in this extraordinary release of energy. But there were some very strange things about this very bright object that actually became known as the BOAT, which stands for the brightest of all time. And it partly because the profile of the radiation didn't really match what you'd expect from a supernova. And not only that, some of the individual gamma rays themselves, these particles of light, had more energy than a particle in the Large Hadron Collider. And that is very puzzling because light with that intensity shouldn't make it through space. It should bounce off stuff on the way and basically get slowed down, lose energy on the way. So there are many things about this event that are quite puzzling. And that's why these anomalies are exciting, because they are the clues that can give us, you know, the next step in our understanding.
Do you find listening to music helps you in your work?
It's interesting, actually. So a lot of what I do is computer coding. So I write algorithms that analyze data. And I find with that, I can listen to more or less anything in the background and it doesn't distract me. And it's actually, sometimes it sort of gives you energy and helps you work. When you're writing, though, it's much more difficult. But I find instrumental music, particularly Yo-Yo Ma's performances of Bach's cello suites, had the right level of energy and kind of also sort of calmed me a little bit and helped the writing process without kind of intruding, I suppose.
And you've chosen the G major prelude by him to close. Harry Cliff, we could have talked well into the night about this fascinating matter. So it only remains for me to thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Thank you.